Chapter 5. When I rode back to General Sheridan's headquarters, after a visit with old friends at Hayes City, I noticed several scouts in a little group engaged in conversation on some important topic. Upon inquiry, I learned that General Sheridan wanted a dispatch sent to Fort Dodge, a distance of 95 miles. The Indians had recently killed two or three men engaged in carrying dispatches over this route. On this account, none of the scouts were at all anxious to volunteer. A reward of several $100 had failed to secure any takers. The scouts had heard of what I had done the day before. They asked me if I did not think the journey to Fort Dodge dangerous. I gave as my opinion that a man might possibly go through without seeing an Indian, but that the chances were 10 to 1 that he would have an exceedingly lively run before he reached his destination, provided he got there at all. Leaving the scouts arguing as to whether any of them would undertake the venture, I reported to General Sheridan. He informed me that he was looking for a man to carry dispatches to Fort Dodge, and, while we were talking, Dick Parr, his chief of scouts, came in to inform him that none of his scouts would volunteer. Upon hearing this, I said, "General, if no one is ready to volunteer, I'll carry your dispatches myself." "I had not thought of asking you to do this, Cody," said the general. "You're already pretty hard worked. But it is really important that these dispatches should go through. If you don't get a courier before 4 this afternoon, I'll be ready for business," I told him. "All I want is a fresh horse. Meanwhile, I'll get a little more rest." It was not much of a rest, however, that I got. I went over to Hayes City and had a time with the boys. Coming back to the post at the appointed hour, I found that no scout had volunteered. I reported to the general, who had secured an excellent horse for me. Handing me the dispatches, he said, "You can start as soon as you wish. The sooner the better. And good luck to you, my boy." An hour later, I was on my way. At dusk, I crossed the Smoky Hill River. I did not urge my horse much, as I was saving him for the latter end of the journey, or for any run I might have to make should the wild boys jump me. Though I kept a sharp watch through the night, I saw no Indians, and had no adventures worth relating. Just at daylight, I found myself approaching Saw Log River, having ridden about 75 miles. A company of colored cavalry, under command of Major Cox, was stationed at this point. I approached the camp cautiously. The darky soldiers had a habit of shooting first and crying halt afterward. When I got within hearing distance, I called out, and was answered by one of the pickets. I shouted to him not to shoot, informing him that I carried dispatches from Fort Hayes. Then, calling the sergeant of the guard, I went up to the vedette, who at once recognized me, and took me to the tent of Major Cox. This officer supplied me with a fresh horse, as requested by General Sheridan in a letter I brought to him. After an hour's sleep and a meal, I jumped into the saddle, and before sunrise was on my way. I reached Fort Dodge, 25 miles further on, between 9 and 10 o'clock without having seen a single Indian. When I had delivered my dispatches, Johnny Austin, an old friend, who was chief of scouts at the post, invited me to come to his house for a nap. When I awoke, Austin told me there had been Indians all around the post. He was very much surprised that I had seen none of them. They had run off cattle and horses, and occasionally killed a man. Indians, he said, were also very thick on the Arkansas River between Fort Dodge and Fort Larned, and had made considerable trouble. The commanding officer of Fort Dodge was very anxious to send dispatches to Fort Larned, but the scouts, like those at Fort Hayes, were backward about volunteering. Fort Larned was my post, and I wanted to go there anyhow. So I told Austin I would carry the dispatches, and if any of the boys wanted to go along, I would be glad of their company. This offer was reported to the commanding officer. He sent for me, and said he would be glad to have me take the dispatches, if I could stand the trip after what I had already done. "All I want is a fresh horse, sir," said I. "I'm sorry we haven't a decent horse," he replied, "but we have a reliable and honest government mule, if that will do you." "Trot out the mule," I told him. "It is good enough for me." I am ready at any time. The mule was forthcoming. A dark eye pulled out for Fort Larned, and proceeded without interruption to Coon Creek, 30 miles from Fort Dodge. I had left the wagon road some distance to the south, and traveled parallel to it. This I decided would be the safer course, as the Indians might be lying in watch for dispatch bearers and scouts along the main road. At Coon Creek I dismounted, and led the mule down to the river, to get a drink of water. While I was drinking, the brute jerked loose and struck out down the creek. I followed him, trusting that he would catch his foot in the bridle rein and stop, but he made straight for the wagon road, where I feared Indians would be lurking, without a pause. At last he struck the road, but instead of turning back toward Fort Dodge he headed for Fort Larned, keeping up a jog trot that was just too fast to permit me to overtake him. I had my gun in hand, and was sorely tempted to shoot him more than once, and probably would have done so but for the fear of bringing the Indians down on me. But he was going my way, so I trudged along after him mile after mile, indulging from time to time in strong language regarding the entire mule fraternity. The mule stuck to the road and kept on for Fort Larned, and I did the same thing. The distance was 35 miles. As day was beginning to break, we, the mule and myself, found ourselves on a hill looking down on the Pawnee Fork, on which Fort Larned was located, only 4 miles away. When the sunrise gun sounded, we were within half a mile of the post. I was thoroughly out of patience by this time. "Now, Mr. Mule," I said, "it is my turn," and threw my gun to my shoulder. Like the majority of government mules, he was not easy to kill. He died hard, but he died. Hearing the report of the gun, the troops came rushing out to see what was the matter. When they heard my story, they agreed that the mule had got no more than his deserts. I took the saddle and bridle and proceeded to the post, where I delivered my dispatches to Captain Parker. I then went to Dick Curtis's house at the scouts' headquarters and put in several hours of solid sleep. During the day, General Hazen returned from Fort Harker. He had important dispatches to send to General Sheridan. I was feeling highly elated over my ride, and as I was breaking the scout records, I volunteered for this mission. The general accepted my offer, though he said there was no necessity of my killing myself. I said I had business which called me to Fort Hays, anyway, and that it would make no difference to the other scouts if he gave me the job, as none of them were particularly eager for the journey. Accordingly, that night, I mounted an excellent horse, and next morning at daylight reached General Sheridan's headquarters at Fort Hays. The general was surprised to see me, and still more so when I told him of the time I had made on the rides I had successfully undertaken. "I believe this record of mine has never been beaten in a country infested with Indians and subject to blizzards and other violent weather conditions. To sum up, I had ridden from Fort Larned to Fort Zra, a distance of 65 miles and back in 12 hours. 10 miles must be added to this for the distance the Indians took me across the Arkansas River. In the succeeding 24 hours I had gone from Fort Larned to Fort Hays, 65 miles, in 8 hours. During the next 24 hours I rode from Fort Hays to Fort Dodge, 95 miles. The following night I traveled from Fort Dodge to Fort Larned, 30 miles on muleback and 35 miles on foot, in 12 hours, and the next night 65 miles more from Fort Larned to Fort Hays. Altogether I had ridden and walked 365 miles in 58 hours, an average of over 6 miles an hour. Taking into consideration the fact that most of this riding was done in the night over wild country, with no roads to follow, and that I had continually to look out for Indians, it was regarded at the time as a big ride as well as a dangerous one. What I have set down here concerning it can be verified by referring to the autobiography of General Sheridan. General Sheridan complimented me highly on this achievement. He told me I need not report back to General Hazen, as he had more important work for me to do. The 5th Cavalry, one of the finest regiments of the Army, was on its way to the Department of the Missouri, and he was going to send an expedition against the Dog Soldier Indians, who were infesting the Republican River region. "Cody," he said, "I am going to appoint you guide and chief of scouts of the command. How does that suit you?" I told him it suited me first rate and thanked him for the honor. The Dog Soldier Indians were a band of Cheyennes and of unruly, turbulent members of other tribes, who would not enter into any treaty, and would have kept no treaty, if they had made one. They had always refused to go on a reservation. They got their name from the word Cheyenne, which is derived from Chen, the French word for dog. On the 3rd of October the 5th Cavalry arrived at Fort Hays, and I at once began making the acquaintance of the members of the regiment. General Sheridan introduced me to Colonel Royal, the commander, whom I found a gallant officer and an agreeable gentleman. I also became acquainted with Major W. H. Brown, Major Walker, Captain Sweetman, Quartermaster E. M. Hayes, and many others of the men, with whom I was soon to be associated. General Sheridan, being anxious to punish the Indians who had lately fought General Forsyth, did not give the regiment much of a rest. On October 5 they began the march to Beaver Creek Country. The first night we camped on the South Fork of Big Creek, 4 miles west of Hays City. By this time I had become well acquainted with Major Brown and Captain Sweetman. They invited me to mess with them, and a jolly mess we had. There were other scouts with the command besides myself. I particularly remember Tom Knahan, Hank Fields, and a character called Nosey. The morning of the 6th we pulled out to the north. During the day I was particularly struck with the appearance of the regiment. It was a beautiful command, and when strung out on the prairies with a train of 75 six-mule wagons, ambulances, and pack mules, I felt very proud of my position as guide and chief of scouts with such a warlike expedition. Just as we were going into camp on the Saline River, that night we ran into a band of some 15 Indians. They saw us, and dashed across the creek, followed by some bullets, which we sent after them. This little band proved to be only a scouting party, so we followed it only a mile or two. Our attention was directed shortly to a herd of buffaloes, and we killed 10 or 15 for the command. Next day we marched 30 miles. When we went into camp, Colonel Royal asked me to go out and kill some buffaloes for the boys. "All right, Colonel," I said, "send along a wagon to bring in the meat. I am not in the habit of sending out my wagons till I know there is something to be hauled in," he said. "Kill your buffaloes first, and I'll send the wagons." Without further words, I went out on my hunt. After a short absence, I returned and asked the colonel to send his wagons for the half dozen buffaloes I had killed. The following afternoon he again requested me to go out after buffaloes. I didn't ask for any wagons this time, but rode out some distance, and, coming upon a small herd, headed 7 or 8 of them directly for the camp. Instead of shooting them, I ran them at full speed right into the place and then killed them one after another in rapid succession. Colonel Royal, who witnessed the whole proceeding, was annoyed and puzzled, as he could see no good reason why I had not killed the buffaloes on the prairie. Coming up angry, he demanded an explanation. "I can't allow any such business as this, Cody," he exclaimed. "What do you mean by it?" "I didn't care about asking for wagons this time, Colonel," I replied. "I thought I would make the buffaloes furnish their own transportation." The colonel saw the force of my defense, and had no more to say on the subject. No Indians had been seen in the vicinity during the day. Colonel Royal, having posted his pickets, supposed that everything was serene for the night. But before morning we were aroused by shots, and immediately afterward one of the mounted pickets came galloping into camp with the announcement that there were Indians close at hand. All the companies fell into line, prepared and eager for action. The men were still new to Indian fighting. Many of them were excited. But, despite the alarm, no Indians made their appearance. Upon going to the post where the picket said he had seen them, none were to be found, nor could the faintest trace be discovered. The sentinel, an Irishman, insisted that there certainly had been redskins there. "But you must be mistaken," said the colonel. "Upon me soul owl, I'm not. As sure as me name's Pat Maloney, one of them red devils hit me on th head with a club." "So he did," persisted the picket. When morning came we made a successful effort to clear up the mystery. Elk tracks were found in the vicinity, and it was undoubtedly a herd of elk that had frightened the picket. When he turned to flee, he must have hit his head on an overhanging limb, which he supposed was the club of a redskin, bent on his murder. It was hard, however, to convince him that he could have been mistaken. 3 days' march brought us to Beaver Creek, where we encamped, and where scouts were sent out in different directions. None of these parties discovered Indians, and they all returned to camp at about the same time. They found it in a state of excitement. A few hours before the return of the scouts, the camp had been attacked by a party of redskins, who had killed 2 men and made off with 60 horses belonging to Company H. That evening the command started on the trail of the horse thieves. Major Brown with 2 companies and 3 days' rations pushed ahead in advance of the main command. On the 18th day out, being unsuccessful in the chase, and nearly out of rations, the entire command marched toward the nearest railroad station and camped on the Saline River, 3 miles distant from Buffalo Tank. While waiting for supplies, we were joined by a new commanding officer, Brevet Major Green Earl E.A. Carr, who was the senior major of the regiment and ranked Colonel Royal. He brought with him the celebrated Forsyth Scouts, who were commanded by Lieutenant Pepoon, a regular army officer. While in this camp, Major Brown welcomed a new lieutenant, who had come to fill a vacancy in the command. This was A.B. Batch, and on the day he was to arrive, Major Brown had his private ambulance brought out, and invited me to ride with him to the railroad station to meet the lieutenant. On the way to the depot, he said, "Now, Cody, we'll give Batch a lively little ride, and shake him up a little." The new arrival was given a back seat in the ambulance, when he got off the train, and we headed for the camp. Presently Major Brown took the reins from his driver, and at once began whipping the mules. When he had got them into a lively gallop, he pulled out his revolver and fired several shots. The road was terribly rough and the night was intensely dark. We could not see where we were going, and it was a wonderful piece of luck that the wagon did not tip over and break our necks. Finally Batch asked, good-humoredly, "Is this the way you break in all your new lieutenants, Major?" "Oh, no," returned the Major. "But this is the way we often ride in this country. Keep your seat, Mr. Batch, and we'll take you through on time," he quoted, from Hank Monk's famous admonition to Horace Greeley. We were now rattling down a steep hill at full speed. Just as we reached the bottom, the front wheels struck a deep ditch, over which the mules had jumped. We were all brought up standing, and Batch plunged forward headlong to the front of the vehicle. "Take the back seat, Lieutenant," said Major Brown sternly. Batch replied that he had been trying to do so, keeping his nerve and his temper. We soon got the wagon out of the ditch and resumed our drive. We swung into camp under full headway, and created considerable amusement. Everyone recognized the ambulance, and knew that Major Brown and I were out for a lark, so little was said about the exploit. Next morning at an early hour the command started out on another Indian hunt. General Carr, who had a pretty good idea where he would be likely to find them, directed me to guide him by the nearest route to Elephant Fork, on Beaver Creek. When we arrived at the South Fork of the Beaver, after 2 days' march, we discovered a fresh Indian trail. We had followed it hurriedly for 8 miles when we discovered, on a bluff ahead, a large number of Indians. General Carr ordered Lieutenant Pepoon's scouts and Company M to the front. Company M was commanded by Lieutenant Sinowski, a reckless daredevil born in France, who was eager for a brush with the Indians. In his anxiety to get into the fight, he pushed his company nearly a mile in advance of the main command, when he was jumped by some 400 Indians. Until our main force could come to his support, he had as lively a little fight as anyone could have asked for. As the battle proceeded, the Indians continued to increase in numbers. At last it became apparent that we were fighting 800 or 1,000 of them. The engagement was general. They were killed and wounded on both sides. The Indians were obviously fighting to give their families and village a chance to get away. We had surprised them with a larger force than they knew was in that part of the country. The battle continued steadily until dark. We drove them before us, but they fought stubbornly. At night they annoyed us by firing down into our camp from the encircling hills. Several times it was necessary to order out the command to dislodge them, and to drive them back where they could do no damage. After one of these sallies, Captain Sweetman, Lieutenant Batch, and myself were taking supper together when whang! Came a bullet into Mr. Batch's plate. We finished our supper without having any more such close calls. At daylight next morning we took the trail again, soon reaching the spot where the Indians had camped the night before. Here there had been a large village, consisting of 500 lodges. Continuing our pursuit, we came in sight of the retreating village at 2 in the afternoon. At once the warriors turned back and gave us battle. To delay us, as much as possible they set fire to the prairie grass in front and on all sides of us. For the remainder of the afternoon we kept up a running fight. Repeatedly the Indians attempted to lead us away from the trail of their fleeing village. But their trail was easily followed by the teepee poles, camp kettles, robes, and all the paraphernalia which proved too heavy to carry for long, and which were dropped in the flight. It was useless to try to follow them after nightfall, and at dark we went into camp. Next morning we were again on the trail, which led north and back toward Beaver Creek. The trail crossed this stream a few miles, from where we had first discovered the Indians. They had made almost a complete circle in the hope of misleading us. Late in the afternoon we again saw them going over a hill far ahead. Toward evening the main body of warriors once more came back and fought us, but we continued to drive them till dusk, when we encamped for the night. Soon the Indians, finding they could not hold out against us, scattered in every direction. We followed the main trail to the Republican River, where we made a cut off and proceeded north toward the Platte. Here we found that the Indians, traveling day and night, had got a long start. General Carr decided we had pushed them so hard, and given them such a thorough scaring that they would leave the Republican country, and go north across the railroad. It seemed, therefore, unnecessary to pursue them any further. Most of the Indians did cross the river near Ogalla as he predicted, and thence continued northward. That night we returned to the Republican River and camped in a grove of cottonwoods, which I named Carr's Grove in honor of our commander. General Carr informed me that the next day's march would be toward the headwaters of the Beaver. I said that the distance was about 25 miles, and he said we would make it the next day. Getting an early start in the morning, we struck out across the prairie. My position, as guide, was the advance guard. About 2 o'clock General Carr overtook me and asked me how far I supposed it was to water. I replied that I thought it was about 8 miles, although we could see no sign of a stream ahead. "Papoon scouts say you are traveling in the wrong direction," said the general. "They say, the way you are bearing, it will be 15 miles, before we strike any branches of the Beaver, and that when you do you will find no water, for they are dry at the season of the year in this locality." "I think the scouts are mistaken, General," I said. "The Beaver has more water near its head than it has below. At the place where we will strike a stream we will find immense beaver dams, big and strong enough to cross your whole command if you wish." "Well, go ahead," he said. "I leave it to you. But, remember, I don't want a dry camp." "No danger of that," I returned and rode on. As I predicted, we found water 7 or 8 miles further on. Hidden in the hills was a beautiful little tributary of the Beaver. We had no trouble in selecting a fine camp with good spring water and excellent grass. Learning that the stream, which was but 8 miles long, was without a name, the general took out his map, and, locating it, christened it Cody's Creek, which name it still bears. Early the next morning we pulled out for the Beaver. As we were approaching the stream I rode on ahead of the advance guard in order to find a crossing. Just as I turned a bend of the creek bang, went a shot, and down went my horse, accompanied by myself. I disentangled myself and jumped clear of the carcass, turning my guns loose at 2 Indians, whom I discovered in the direction from which the shot had come. In the suddenness of it all I missed my aim. The Indians fired 2 or 3 more shots, and I returned the compliment by wounding one of their horses. On the other side of the creek I saw a few lodges moving rapidly away, and also mounted warriors. They also saw me, and began blazing away with their guns. The Indians who had killed my horse were retreating across the creek, using a beaver dam for a bridge. I accelerated their pace by sending a few shots after them and also fired at the warriors across the stream. I was undecided as to whether it would be best to run back to the command on foot, or to retain my position. The troops, I knew, would come up in a few minutes. The sound of the firing would hasten their arrival. The Indians soon saw that I was alone. They turned and charged down the hill, and were about to cross the creek and corral me, when the advance guard of the command appeared over the ridge, and dashed forward to my rescue. Then the Redskins rolled and made off. When General Carr arrived, he ordered Company I to pursue the band. I accompanied Lieutenant Brady, who commanded the company. For several hours we had a running fight with the Indians, capturing several of their horses and most of their lodges. At night we returned to the command, which by this time had crossed the dam. For several days we scouted along the river. We had two or three lively skirmishes, but at last our supplies began to run low, and the general ordered us to return to Fort Wallace, which we reached 3 days afterward. While the regiment remained here, waiting for orders, I spent most of my time hunting buffaloes. One day, while I was out with a small party, 50 Indians jumped us, and we had a terrific battle for an hour. We finally managed to drive them off, with four of their warriors killed. With me were a number of excellent marksmen, and they did fine work, sending bullets thick and fast where they would do the most execution. Two or three of our horses were hit. One man was wounded. We were ready and willing to stay with the Indians as long as they would stay with us. But they gave it up at last. We finished our hunt, and returned to the post with plenty of buffalo meat. Here we received the compliments of General Carr on our little fight. In a few days orders came from General Sheridan, to make a winter campaign in the Canadian River country. We were to proceed to Fort Lyon on the Arkansas River, and fit out for the expedition. Leaving Fort Wallace in November, 1868, we arrived at Fort Lyon in the latter part of the month, and began the work of outfitting. 3 weeks before this, General Penrose had left the post with a command of 300 men. He had taken no wagons with him. His supply train was composed of pack mules. General Carr was ordered to follow with supplies on Penrose's trail, and to overtake him as soon as possible. I was particularly anxious to catch up with Penrose's command, as my old friend, Wild Bill, was among his scouts. For the first 3 days we followed the trail easily. Then we were caught in freeze-out cannon by a fearful snowstorm. This compelled us to go into camp for a day. It now became impossible longer to follow Penrose's trail. The ground was covered with snow, and he had left no sign to show in which direction he was going. General Carr sent for me, and told me it was highly important that we should not lose the trail. He instructed me to take some scouts, and, while the command remained in camp, to push on as far as possible to seek for some sign that would indicate the direction Penrose had taken. Accompanied by four men, I started out in a blinding snowstorm. We rode 24 miles in a southerly direction till we reached a tributary of the Cimarron. From here we scouted up and down the stream for a few miles, and at last turned up one of Penrose's old camps. It was now late in the afternoon. If the camp was to come up the next day, it was necessary for us to return immediately with our information. We built a fire in a sheltered spot, broiled some venison we had shot during the day, and after a substantial meal I started back alone, leaving the others behind. It was 11 o'clock when I got back into camp. A light was still burning in General Carr's tent. He was sitting up to await my return. He was overjoyed at the news I brought him. He had been extremely anxious concerning the safety of Penrose. Rousing up his cook, he ordered a hot supper for me, which, after my long, cold ride, I greatly appreciated. I passed the night in the general's tent, and woke the next morning fully refreshed and ready for a big day's work. The snow had drifted deeply overnight, and the command had a hard tramp through it, when it set out next morning for the Cimarron. In many ravines the drifts had filled into a great depth. Often the teamsters had to shovel their way through. At sundown we reached the Cimarron, and went into a nice warm camp. The next morning, on looking around, we found that Penrose, who was not encumbered with wagons, had kept on the west side of the Cimarron. Here the country was so rough that we could not stay on the trail with wagons. But we knew that he would continue down the river, and the general gave orders to take the best route downstream, which I found to be on the east side. Before we could make any headway with our wagon trains, we had to leave the river and get out on the divide. For some distance we found a good road, but suddenly we were brought up standing on a high tableland overlooking the beautiful winding creek that lay far below us. How to get the wagons down became a serious problem for the officers. We were in the foothills of the rough Raton Mountains. The bluff we were on was steep and rugged. "Cody," said General Carr, "we're in a nice fix now." "That's nothing," I replied. "But you never can take the train down."
"Never mind the train, General. You're looking for a good camp. How does that valley suit you?"
"That will do," he said. "I can easily descend with the cavalry, but how to get the wagons down is a puzzler." "By the time your camp is located, the wagons will be there," I said.
"All right," he returned.
"I'll leave it to you, inasmuch as you seem to want to be the boss." He ordered the command to dismount and lead the horses down the mountain. When the wagon train, which was a mile in the rear, came up, one of the drivers asked, "How are we going to get down there?"
"Run down, slide down, fall down, any way to get down," I told him.
"We never can do it," said another wagon master.
"It's too steep. The wagons will run over the mules."
"Oh, no," I said. "The mules will have to keep out of the way." I instructed Wilson, the chief wagon master, to bring up his mess wagon. He drove the wagon to the brink of the bluff. Following my directions, he brought out extra chains with which we locked both wells on each side, and then rough lock. This done, we started the wagons down the hill. The wheel horses, or rather the wheel mules, were good on the hold back, and we got along beautifully till the wagon had nearly reached the bottom of the declivity. Then the wagon crowded the mules so hard that they started on the run, and came galloping down into the valley to the spot General Carr had selected for his camp. There was not the slightest accident. Three other wagons followed in the same way. In half an hour every wagon was in the camp. It was an exciting sight to see the six mule teams come almost straight down the mountainside and finally break into a run. At times it seemed certain that the wagon must turn a somersault and land on the mules, but nothing of the kind happened. Our march proved to be a lucky one so far as gaining on Penrose was concerned. The route he had taken on the west side of the stream was rough and bad, and with our great wagon train we made as many miles in one day as he had in seven. His command had taken a high table land, whose sides were so steep that not even a pack mule could make the descent, and he had been obliged to retrace the trail for a great distance, losing 3 days while doing so. The incident of this particular camp we had selected was an exciting turkey hunt. We found the trees along the river bank literally alive with turkeys. After unsaddling the horses, 200 or 300 soldiers surrounded a grove of timber, and there was a grand turkey roundup. Guns, clubs, and even stones were used as weapons. Of course, after the hunt we had roast turkey, boiled turkey, fried turkey, and turkey on toast for our fare, and in honor of the birds which had provided this treat we named the place Camp Turkey. When we left camp we had an easy trail for several days. Penrose had taken a southerly direction toward the Canadian River. No Indians were to be seen, nor did we find any signs of them. One day, while riding in advance of the command down San Francisco Creek, I heard someone calling my name from a little bunch of willow brush on the opposite bank of the stream. Looking closely at the spot, I saw a colored soldier.
"Sakes alive, Massa Bill, am dat you?" shouted the man, whom I recognized as a member of the 10th Cavalry.
"Come out, Oha," I heard him call to someone behind him.
"Huz Massa Buffalo Bill."
Then he sang out to me, "Massa Bill, is you got any odd tack?"
"Very a bit of hard tack, but the wagons will be along presently, and you can get all you want."
"Dat's de best news Oz ha odd fo 16 long days, Massa Bill.
Where's your command? Where's General Penrose? I demanded.
Dunno, said the darkey. We got lost, and we's been starving ever since.
By this time two other Negroes had emerged from their hiding place. They had deserted Penrose's command, which was out of rations and in a starving condition. They were trying to make their way back to Old Fort Lyon.
General Carr concluded, from what they could tell him, that Penrose was somewhere on Polydora Creek. But nothing definite was to be gleaned from the starving darkies, for they knew very little themselves.
General Carr was deeply distressed to learn that Penrose and his men were in such bad shape. He ordered Major Brown to start out the next morning with two companies of cavalry and 50 pack mules, loaded with provisions, and to make all possible speed, to reach and relieve the suffering soldiers. I went with this detachment. On the third day out we found the half-famished soldiers encamped on the Polydora. The camp presented a pitiful sight. For over 2 weeks the men had only quarter rations, and were now nearly starved to death. Over 200 mules were lying dead, having succumbed to fatigue and starvation. Penrose, having no hope that he would be found, had sent back a company of the 7th Cavalry to Fort Lyon for supplies. As yet no word had been heard from them. The rations brought by Major Brown arrived none too soon. They were the means of saving many lives. Almost the first man I saw after reaching the camp was my true and tried friend, Wild Bill. That night we had a jolly reunion around the campfires. When General Carr came up with his force, he took command of all the troops, as he was the senior officer. When a good camp had been selected he unloaded his wagons, and sent them back to Fort Lyon for supplies. He then picked out 500 of the best men and horses, and, taking his pack train with him, started south for the Canadian River. The remainder of the troops were left at the supply camp. I was ordered to accompany the expedition bound for the Canadian River. We struck the south fork of the stream at a point a few miles above the old adobe walls that were once a fort. Here Kit Carson had had a big Indian fight. We were now within 12 miles of a new supply depot called Fort Evans, established for the 3rd Cavalry and Evans's expedition from New Mexico. The scouts who brought this information reported also that they expected the arrival of a bull train from New Mexico with a large quantity of beer for the soldiers. Wild Bill and I determined to lay for this beer. That very evening it came along, and the beer destined for the soldiers at Fort Evans never reached them. It went straight down the thirsty throats of General Carr's command. The Mexicans living near Fort Evans had brewed the beer. They were taking it to Fort Evans, to sell to the troops. But it found a better market without going so far. It was sold to our boys in pine cups, and, as the weather was very cold, we warmed it by putting the ends of our picket pins, heated red hot, into the brew, before we partook of it. The result was one of the biggest beer jollifications it has ever been my misfortune to attend. One evening General Carr summoned me to his tent. He said he wanted to send some scouts with dispatches to Fort Supply, to be forwarded from there to General Sheridan. He ordered me to call the scouts together, and to select the men who were to go. I asked if I were to go, but he replied that he could not spare me. The distance to Camp Supply was about 200 miles. Because of the very cold weather it was sure to be a hard trip. None of the scouts were at all keen about undertaking it, but it was finally settled that Wild Bill, Little Gary, a half-breed, and three other scouts should carry the dispatches. They took their departure the next day with orders to return as soon as possible. We scouted for several days along the Canadian River, finding no sign of Indians. The general then returned to camp, and soon our wagon train returned with provisions from Fort Lyon. Our animals were in poor condition, so we remained in different camps along San Francisco Creek, and on the North Fork of the Canadian till Wild Bill and his scouts returned from Fort Supply. Among the scouts in Penrose's command were 15 Mexicans. Among them and the Americans a bitter feud existed. When Carr united Penrose's command with his own, and I was made chief of scouts, this feud grew more intense than ever. The Mexicans often threatened to clean us out, but they postponed the execution of the threat from time to time. At last, however, when we were all in the sutler's store, The long-expected fight took place, with the result that the Mexicans were severely beaten. On hearing of the row, General Carr sent for Wild Bill and me. From various reports he had made up his mind that we were the instigators of the affair. After listening to what we had to say, however, he decided that the Mexicans were as much to blame as we were. It is possible that both Wild Bill and I had imbibed a few more drinks than we needed that evening. General Carr said to me, "Cody, there are plenty of antelopes in the country. You can do some hunting while we stay here." After that my time was spent in the chase, and I had fine success. I killed from 20 to 25 antelopes every day, and the camp was supplied with fresh meat. When the horses and mules belonging to the outfit had been sufficiently recruited to travel, we returned to Fort Lyon, reaching there in March, 1869. The command recruited and rested for 30 days before proceeding to the Department of the Platte, whither it had been ordered. At my request, General Carr kindly granted me a month's leave of absence to visit my family in St. Louis. He instructed Captain Hayes, our quartermaster, to let me ride my mule and horse to Sheridan, 140 miles distant. At Sheridan I was to take the train for St. Louis. I was instructed to leave the animals in the quartermaster's corral at Fort Wallace until I should come back. Instead of doing this, I put them both in charge of my old friend Perry, the hotel keeper at Sheridan. After 20 days, pleasantly spent with my family at St. Louis, I returned to Sheridan. There I learned that my horse and mule had been seized by the government. The quartermaster's agent at Sheridan had reported to General Bankhead, commanding at Fort Wallace, and to Captain Luffer, the quartermaster, that I had left the country, and had sold the animals to Perry. Luffer took possession of the animals, and threatened to have Perry arrested for buying government property. He refused to pay any attention to Perry's statement that I would return in a few days, and that the animals had merely been left in his care. As soon as I found this out, I proceeded to the office of the quartermaster's agent, who had told this lie, and gave him the thrashing he richly deserved. When I had finished with him, he hastened to the fort, reported what had happened, and returned with a guard to protect him. Next morning, securing a horse from Perry, I rode to Fort Wallace, and demanded my horse and mule from General Bankhead. I told him they were Quartermaster Hayes's property, and belonged to General Carr's command, and explained that I had obtained permission to ride them to Sheridan and return. General Bankhead gruffly ordered me out of his office and off the reservation, declaring that if I didn't leave in a hurry he would have me removed by force. I told him he might do this and be hanged, using, very possibly, a stronger expression. That night, while sleeping at the Perry house, I was awakened by a tap on my shoulder, and was astonished to see the room filled with armed Negro soldiers with their guns all pointed at me. The first word came from the sergeant. "Now look, Massa Bill, if you move we'll blow you off the farm, suah." Just then Captain Ezekiel entered, and ordered the soldiers to stand back. "I'm sorry, Bill," he said, when I demanded to know what this meant. "But I've been ordered by General Bankhead to arrest you and bring you to Fort Wallace." "All right," said I. "But you could have made the arrest without bringing the whole 38th Infantry with you." "I know that, Bill, but you've not been in a very good humor the last day or two, and we didn't know how you'd act." I dressed hurriedly and accompanied the captain to Fort Wallace. When we reached there at 2 o'clock in the morning, the captain said, "Bill, I'm sorry, but my orders are to put you in the guardhouse." I told him I did not blame him for carrying out orders, and was made a guardhouse prisoner for the first and only time in my life. The sergeant of the guard, who was an old friend from Captain Graham's company, refused to put me in a cell, kindly allowing me to sleep in his own bed, and in a few minutes I was sound asleep. Captain Graham called to see me in the morning. He said it was a shame to lock me up, and promised to speak to the general about it. At guard mount, when I was not summoned, I sent word to Captain Graham that I wanted to see General Bankhead. He sent back word that the general refused to have anything to do with me. As it was impossible to send word to General Carr, I determined to send a dispatch direct to General Sheridan. I wrote out a long telegram, informing him of my difficulty. but when it was taken to the telegraph office for transmission, the operator refused to send it at once. Instead, he showed it to General Bankhead, who tore it up. When no reply came, I went to the office, accompanied by a guard, and learned from the operator what he had done. "See here, my young friend," said I, "this is a public telegraph line. I want my telegram sent, or there'll be trouble." He knew very well it was his duty to send the dispatch. I rewrote it and gave it to him, with the money to pay for it. But before he made any effort to transmit it, he called on General Bankhead and informed him of what I had said. Seeing that the dispatch would have to go through, the general sent for me. "If I let you go, sir, will you leave the post at once and not bother anyone at Sheridan?" he demanded. "No, sir," I replied, "I'll do nothing of the kind. I'll remain in the guardhouse till I get an answer from General Sheridan. If I give you your horse and mule, will you proceed at once to Fort Lyon?" "No, sir, I have some bills to settle at Sheridan and some other business to transact." "Well, sir, will you at least promise not to interfere any further with the quartermaster's agent at Sheridan?"
"I shall not trouble him any more, sir. I have had all I want from him."
General Bankhead thereupon sent for Captain Luffer, and ordered him to turn the horse and mule over to me. In a few minutes I was on my way to Sheridan, and, having settled my business there, I proceeded to Fort Lyon, arriving there 2 days afterward. I related my adventures to General Carr, Major Brown, and the other officers, who were highly amused thereby.